one of you, please take a moment or two before you get away to fill it out. And when you do, would you please leave it at the registration desk as you leave? As Dr. Mitra indicated this morning, this approach to providing courses is a bit new as far as the IEEE is concerned. This information is needed in light of the possibility of mounting more of the same type. I also ask you to indicate on the questionnaire two items. One, what cost would you anticipate such a course to be? That's one item I've been asked to have you put on. What's a realistic cost in your estimation? We're looking for this type of information, the IEEE is. The second point, could you indicate if you are company funded or whether you're individually funded? Those are the two items if you'd ask, add them to the questionnaire, please. The kit which parallels this course will be available. They have them now, they're assembled. They will be at the registration desk beginning about 1 o'clock or 1:15. So if you have to leave before the session is over and you wish a kit, stop by and Mrs. White and her staff will supply you with one. The cost is $20, and I think perhaps you know the elements of that kit. The notes which you have as part of your tuition fee are costed at the rate of $10 if you wish to acquire further copies of these notes. These can be purchased from, again, Mrs. White at the registration desk. That's all I have. Is there any quick questions? Okay. Mr. Forshaw, would you take over, please?
For the next hour or so, we should be discussing binary arithmetic, counters, and registers. If you're following this in the course notes, you'll find that this is the first half of Lecture 3 and the whole of Lecture 5. Industrial control often requires the need to count events or sequence events. Electronic logic, according to its two-state nature, lends itself very readily to counting in the binary system rather than the decimal system that you and I are used to. Therefore, no seminar of this nature would be complete without some discussion of binary arithmetic previous to the discussion of counting circuits. In the binary system, we use the two digits 0 and 1 to represent any number. We say that the radix or base of the binary system is 2, as against the radix or base of 10 in the decimal system. This slide shows the equivalent numbers between decimal and binary. Let's just go through the conventional operation of counting in decimal. In decimal, we have 10 characters or digits, 0 through 9, to represent any number. But we proceed in counting from 0, 1, 2, 3, up to 9. When we get to 9, we, as it were, run out of available digits that are no more at our disposal. So we get over this problem by recycling again through the 10 digits, 0 through 9, but this time preceding every 1 with a 1. This takes us up to 19, and then we proceed each with 2 to 29. And so on up to 99, and if we wish to count even further, then we recycle through the whole number again. And this is quite commonplace if you're used to operating in this system. But binary is exactly the same, except that we run out of available digits much earlier. So if we proceed to count in binary here, we start off at 0, 1, and now we run out. So this time we proceed the sequence with the character of digit 1, and so we have 1, 0, 1, 1. This is analogous, shall we say, to reaching the stage of 99 in the decimal system. So we've now cycled through four different counts from 0 to 1, 1. To carry on, we precede each number with the character 1, and again cycle through up to 1, 1, 1. We can proceed to count in this way, and you may think, well, this isn't a very efficient way, because we need many digits to represent large numbers, and this generally is true. The ratio is about 3 to 1, the binary to decimal. Thus, if you have, say, a 3-digit decimal number, the number of binary digits, or bits, needed to represent that number will be about 3 times as much. Take a number like 340, a 3-decimal-digit number, you should be able to use about 9 or 10 binary bits to represent it. So it's really not so much bigger. The binary and decimal system are both positional in nature. That is to say, the position of the bit 0 or 1 within the number is indicative of its magnitude, its relative magnitude. Thus, the number here 1101, which happens to be the binary equivalent of the decimal 13, which we can check from our columns up here. What this actually means is 1 multiplied by 2 to the power of 0, which is 1, plus 0 times 2 to the power of 1, plus 1 times 2 to the power of 2 or 4, plus 1 times 2 to the power of 3. The weightings of columns increase from the right to the left. The weighting of the rightmost column is unity or 1. The weighting of the next is 2, 4, 8, 16, and so forth. It's exactly the same in the decimal system, except that in decimal we don't deal in powers of 2, but in powers of 10. So the weighting of our least significant or rightmost column is 1, 10, 100, 1000, and so forth. 10 to the power of 0, 1, 2, 3. So the two systems are very much the same, but the ratings are different. Now this particular system then gives us a very convenient way of converting between binary and decimal. All we need to do is to inspect where bits occur in a number and the magnitude of that particular column or the weighting of that column and add up the weightings of columns where bits occur. Thus here, 8 plus 4 is 12 plus 1 is 13. It's very simple really for us to convert from binary to decimal, but it's not so simple for electronic logic systems, as we shall see, and we'll have to have some means of overcoming this problem when we need to convert between numbering systems. To convert a decimal number, such as 35, into binary, we divide the number successively by the radix 2. This is a rather interesting method, only one of several, incidentally. But it's rather interesting because it's equally applicable to, say, octal system or any other system with a radix less than 10. Thus, 35, 2s into 35, gives us 17, and we record the remainder over here. 2 into 17 is 8, gain 1 left over. 2 into 8 is 4, with 0 remainder. 2 into 4 is 2, 0 over. 2 into 2 is 1, with 0 over. And finally, 2 into 1 is 0, with 1 remainder. And the binary number is this number, 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, reading from the bottom to the top. And one can fairly easily check this. If we just look at the weightings, we have 1 plus 2. That's not coming through too well on the slide. But we have a weighting here of 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32. So what we have is 1 plus 2, which is 3, plus 32, which is 35. So the system does appear to work. Well, as I mentioned, one of the problems with the binary system is that it's rather difficult to convert between binary and decimal. In a digital computer, it's not necessary to convert between binary and decimal. But if you're dealing with something like a digital voltmeter or a frequency counter, some situation, some control system where you have some human interaction with the system, a human interface, since the human being relates in terms of decimal, you have to have a means of conversion. A typical example might be a work table which is positioned underneath the drill head, and it's necessary to read out the x and y coordinates in inches of the drill head and the work table. It would be quite impractical to read that out as a string of 1 and 0 in binary. Thus, there has to be some means of conversion and display. And the binary system does not lend itself to this. So So we have to consider a hybrid type of code called binary copy decimal, which is halfway between binary and decimal. Now, this afternoon, I'm only going to cover the simplest of these, called 8421 BCD. It's been calculated theoretically that there are about 30,000 million different possible ways of representing BCD numbers. Needless to say, not all of them are in practice, perhaps about half a dozen or so. The 8421 code is the simplest and is very similar to binary. Let's see how it works. If we wish to convert the number 289 into 8421 BCD, we split the decimal digits into the 2, the 3, and the 9, and convert each decimal digit into its 4-bit binary equivalent. Thus, the number 2 comes down as 0010. Remember, it must be a 4-bit binary number, hence the leading zeros. 3 will come through as 0011, and 9 will come through as 1001. And the validity of this can be checked in the table I gave on the previous slide. We end up then with a string of 12 binary digits, 12-bit number, which represents 239 decimal. This is quite different from binary. If you were to convert 239 into binary, you'll find it is certainly not the same number. Conversion the other way is not too difficult. Let's take this number, which will come out to be 329. We have the number 0110010001. We proceed to split this number into groups of 4 from the right. So our rightmost group of 4 is 1001, the next is 0010, and the next is 011. Perhaps more correctly, this should be written 0011 to make it a true 4-bit number. We then individually convert these groups of 4 into their decimal equivalent. 1001 becomes 9, 0010 as 2, 0011 as 3. Thus, in order to convert from BCD to decimal, all we have to do is have a system which is capable of remembering, if you will, the particular combinations of ones and zeros in a 4-bit number and the appropriate decimal equivalent. So it just has to remember 10 particular facts about BCD to decimal. And a logical circuit which can do this can be readily built. To convert something like, for example, a 6-bit pure binary number into decimal would be quite a difficult job and would involve Raymond gates. It would be quite a complex problem. You may like to try it sometimes, it's an interesting exercise, and you'll find it extremely difficult to do. Sometimes in control systems it's necessary to perform some arithmetic operation in binary, and this afternoon we'll only consider the operation of binary addition. Let's just quickly review decimal addition. When we were first learning the rules of decimal addition, it's a long time ago, maybe you remember, there were many, many different rules that you really had to commit to memory. There was no logical way of working it out unless you resorted to counting on your fingers, which is always rather a slow process. But rules like 7 plus 6 is 3 and 1's a carry is just one of them. And there are quite a few. Now, in binary, we have the same kind of situation where we have rules that need to be remembered. But fortunately, since we're only dealing with a two-state system, we only have two numbers anyway, two digits to deal with, the rules are quite simple and follow very much from what we know of decimal arithmetic anyway. The first rule of binary arithmetic is that 0 plus 0 is 0. The second rule is that 0 plus 1 is 1. The third rule is that 1 plus 1 is 0 plus a carry. Really, it's only the third rule, the third of this group of 3, which is a little bit different from what we used to. We couldn't, of course, write 1 plus 1 is equal to 2, because 2 doesn't exist in the binary system. 1 plus 1 is 0 plus a carry is similar to, let's say, 5 plus 5 in the decimal system. 5 plus 5 is 0 plus a carry. And there is a fourth rule, which I've given here, which really is a derivation of the earlier ones, And it says that 1 plus 1 plus 1 is 1 plus a carry. Now, armed with these three rules and this fourth derivation of the previous ones, we can add up two binary numbers. For example, here is the number 0111, which represents decimal 7. Here is the number 0011, which represents decimal 3. 7 plus 3 should give us 101010. It works like this. Starting off just as in decimal arithmetic with the rightmost column, we have 1 plus 1 gives us a 0, and the carry is taken over to the next more significant column. And here we apply our fourth rule, 1 plus 1 plus 1 gives us a 1 plus a carry. Here we apply the third rule, 1 plus 1 is a 0. The carry is generated over into the final column, coming down as a 1, giving us our final binary number of 10, which is 10, since the weighting of the least significant bit is 1. We have a 2, no 4s, and an 8. 8 plus 2 giving us 10. So it does appear to work. Now we can build logical systems which can conform to these rules of binary arithmetic, and we call them, not surprisingly, adders. And we have here a truth table of what's called a half adder. We'll see in a moment why it's only a half adder and we'll probably want a full adder. But what the half adder aims to do is to take two binary bits, which we call A and B, and compute a sum bit and a carry bit according to the previous rules, the first three rules of binary arithmetic, not the fourth rule. If A and B are both zero, this should give us a sum of zero and a carry of zero. If A is one and B is zero, the sum should be one, but no carry. Likewise, if A is 0 and B is 1, we should get a sum, but no carry. In the event that both A and B are 1 simultaneously, there will be no sum, but there will be a carry. Now this relatively simple little truth table here can be implemented in any particular logic, and I've shown here its implementation in NOR logic. It can equally well be done in NAND logic or in mixtures of the two. I shan't go through it. I don't think it's worthwhile at this stage in plowing through the logic and the derivation of this using De Morgan's theorem, but to do that, I refer you to the first lecture this morning, where you can readily see the identities that are written here. But why is it called a half adder? Well, if we go back to our previous slide, we'll see that when we were performing this arithmetic, this binary addition, and we were at the rightmost column, we have two digits to handle, which we might call our A and B digits, but only two. When we come to the next, we have three digits, potentially anyway. There may be a carry from the previous stage. In some situations, there may not be, but you're never going to know that. Now, the truth table that we've just looked at assumed there are only two inputs to the adder, A and B, and computed the sum and carry accordingly. But in a real-life situation, apart from the most significant addition, the least significant column addition over here, all other additions have to take into account the two bits, A and B, in the previous carry from the previous stage. And for this purpose, we need a full adder. The truth table for a full adder, then, must take into account all eight combinations from the two inputs, A and B, and the carry from the preceding stage. A, B, and C, if these are all zero, then a sum should be zero and no carry. If any one of them is true, then there must be a sum but no carry, and this occurs here with A0, B1, C0, and it occurs here with A1, B0, C0. The next situation is where we have both A and B1 and C0, and this should generate a zero sum and a carry, conforming to, I think it was the third rule of binary addition. In fact, the next column is just 1 plus 0, giving us a sum of 1 and a carry of 0. The next is 1 plus 1, giving us 0 sum and a single 1 carry. The next again is 1 plus 1, giving us a sum of 0 and a carry. And finally, The fourth rule, the one that was derived from the earlier one, is implemented when A, B, and C are all run simultaneously to generate a sum and a carry simultaneously. Well, now, the logic of this looks like this slide, where a full adder is seen to consist of two half adders plus the extra OR gate. And here again, I really don't think there's too much benefit in working through this to see that this actually does conform to this diagram. It's a long process, but essentially a fairly simple one. It just involves examining all possible intermediate carriers and sums for all possible input conditions of A, B, and C in. So what we've talked about is an electronic circuit which is capable of adding together two or three binary bits. But we've not necessarily talked about how a string of flip-flop circuits are capable of adding binary numbers. This is a further extension of this basic idea. Now I want to continue with the discussion of counters and registers. This is lecture number 5 in the notes. As you'll notice, there are sections of the notes which we just cannot hope to cover in a single day seminar like this. The seminar was initially given over a period of 8 weeks, 3 hours a night, so we have to, there have to be one or two casualties. I'm afraid the rest of the part of the binary arithmetic is one of them. A register consists of a series of bistable devices, or flip-flops, as discussed this morning, arranged in some string or row, some logical sequence, such that it's capable of storing a binary number. We say a flip-flop is set, or reset. If it's set, we can just choose to call that the 1 condition. If it's reset, we call it the 0 condition. So if we have 4 flip-flops arranged in a row, then we could represent a 4-bit binary number, decimal equivalents 0 through 15. In general, with an n-bit row, a row of n flip-flops, we can represent binary numbers from 0 to 2 to the n minus 1. The whole realm of counters can be subdivided into these three general areas and could be further subdivided also. This is the way I've handled it for this presentation. First of all, we're going to talk about asynchronous types of counters, otherwise called serial counters, and also ripple or ripple-through counters. The second type are synchronous in nature, sometimes called clocked. And the third type, which really, I suppose, could be considered a subgroup of number 2, chip counters and registers. There's also a further group, I suppose we could cover bidirectional counters, which are capable of counting up and downs. The terms register and counter are very often used at one and the same time. Strictly speaking, they don't mean the same thing. A register is something that's capable of storing a number, and this is its main purpose in life. A counter is something which is capable of accumulating this count as consecutive clock inputs are applied. Thus, a counter is initially set to 0000, and 9 clock pulses are applied and expected to accumulate to a count of 1001, binary to decimal 5. Let's talk first of all about one of the simplest counters, the serial binary counter shown here. This uses the JNK, the JK flip-flop. Indeed, all the counters and registers in this part of the presentation use JK flip-flops. As Dr. Little mentioned this morning, the JK flip-flop is undoubtedly the most versatile of all the flip-flops. Many of these circuits can, of course, be implemented in other types of flip-flops. Just recalling the truth table of the JK flip-flop, you remember that for a change to occur in a JK flip-flop, we must have an input clock pulse. And I have chosen the convention with these JK flip-flops, it must be a negative going transition on the plot line to cause some change. Now, the kind of change that occurs is dependent upon the state of the JK lines when the input transition occurs, and the conditions are as follows. If both J and K are low, then there is no action. They inhibit the clock pulse. If both J and K are high, then we get toggling or complementing. For every input clock pulse, the state will change. It was previously a 0, it will become a 1, if a 1 is 0. If J is high, it will set to 1. If it's already set to 1, it will stay there. If it was previously 0, it will set to 1. And if K is high, it will set, or it will reset to 0. So we have these four possible combinations. JK low, inhibit, JK high, toggle, J high set to 1, K high, reset to 0. The serial binary counter then has got the one output of every flip-flop connected into the clock input of the next. And all J and K lines are connected to high. This means to say that upon application of a clock pulse of the right polarity, that is say negative going transition on a clock line, the state of the flip-flop will switch. If we initially then assume that A, B, C, and D are all reset to zero, this is represented by state zero here in the counter sequence diagram. I should caution you, by the way, that A, B, C, and D for the actual circuit diagram here, A is the least significant bit, and it is shown on the left in a normal convention for electronic circuits, whereas when we come down to represent it as a binary number, you'll notice it switched places. So be a little bit aware of that fact, that on occasion we switch the whole thing around, A for D and B for C. So we start off at 0, A, B, C, and D are all 0, and we apply a single clock pulse, a negative going transition. When this occurs, A will complement to the 1 state. If it's in the 1 state, the 1 output will be high, and this will do nothing further, since a positive going transition on a clock line will have no effect to a flip-flop, regardless of the state of J and K lines. So there we step, this is represented then, 0, 0, 0, 1, or binary for 1. Application of the next clock pulse, however, will cause A to complement back to the 0 state, causing the 1 output to fall to 0, generating a negative going transition into the clock line of B, thus complementing B to the 1 state, giving us a count of 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 0, 1, 0. Application of the next clock pulse again complements A to the 1 state. This has no effect on B, since a positive going level change occurs on the clock input to B, which is not of the right polarity. So there we stay at 0, 0, 1, 1. In this way then, the counter accumulates input pulses up to a maximum count of 1, 1, 1, 1, or decimal 15. Application of a further clock pulse will cause A to reset to 0, generating a negative going pulse on the clock to B. B will then complement to 0, C will complement to 0, and D will complement to 0, and we'll end up at our initial state, and the counter will have cycled through 16 discrete states. It's important to realize that this is a serial type counter, or why it's important to realize why this is called serial in nature. Imagine the change of state from 1111 back to 0. Application of a clock pulse causes A to switch, but A must switch before B can switch. Likewise, B must switch before C can. Thus, if we have a state change involving all four flip-flops, you can imagine this change rippling through the whole string of counters, or string of flip-flops, and you can see that the change of state is serial in nature, hence the word serial ripple. Now, this causes problems. One problem is that the switching time of a particular flip-flop is quite finite. It's not it happens in a matter of nanoseconds, but it can introduce quite a considerable propagation delay between an input clock pulse and the final change of state. Perhaps it's not so important for a 4-bit counter, but for a 16 or 24-bit register, it could be quite significant. And we must have the new state assumed before we apply the next clock pulse. Therefore, it will set an upper limit to the maximum frequency at which a counter like this can count. But a more serious problem occurs if we attempt to decode that counter, that is to say, sense a particular combination of ones and zeros. imagine if we're changing from 1111 back to 000, that every flip-flop is going to change. Every flip-flop is going to change at a slightly different time from the others. Thus, if we could freeze moments of time, say intervals of nanoseconds or so, between this transition from 15 back to 0, we might, at any one particular time, have any particular combination of ones and zeros. This could confuse decoding logic which was attached to this counter and could cause erratic and improper operation of such a logical system. However, such a counter has the merits of being fairly simple, fairly inexpensive. There are no gates between stages, which I'd expect. And it can be used for frequency division by powers of two in this case, with an input clock pulse to train, as shown here. The output of the A1 output will be half the input frequency, the B1 output will be a quarter, C will be an eighth, and D will be a sixteenth. Thus, for dividing by powers of two, the circuit is ideal, as we shall see there are circuits which are capable of dividing by other than powers of two, such as you can divide by any integer that you require frequency dividing. That then is the simplest type of counter. Let's look at another counter, a serial counter again. Now, this is a binary coded decimal, 8421 binary coded decimal counter. Again, it consists of 4 JK flip flops. What we have these extra lines in here and an extra 2 input NOR gate. The purpose of this counter is to cycle through binary 0000 to binary for 9 1001. But application of the next clock pulse should cause the counter to reset to 0. It's thus counting in 8421 BCD and could represent a single decade of a multiple decade counting system. There are illegal states in this count. In this cycle, the legal states corresponding to the decimal for 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, and 15. And we must consider this in the design, as we shall see. Let's have a look and see how the device works. The first flip-flop has both J and K high, thus there is no question about it. Flip-flop A will complement for every clock pulse that is applied. Let's have a look at flip-flops B and C though. The J line for flip-flop B is connected to the NOT-D output of flip-flop D. Since this will normally be high when we start off with a count of 0, this will be of no consequence, with J high and K also high. Negative going transitions from A onto the clock input of B will cause B to complement. However, it's important to realize that as soon as D is set to 1, its zero output, not D output, will fall, therefore inhibiting action in flip-flops B and subsequently C. Under what conditions will flip-flop D be switched? Well, if we look at the NOR gate output here, we will see that it is normally low, and it will only go high when B and C are set to the 1 state. In other words, when we have a low output on not B and not C. And this is normally true. So we count in the usual way up to a count of, let's say, 7 in binary, and we have A1, B1, C1, and D0. Now, with B and C both on, this is conducive to D switching to the 1 state, which it will do, and A will complement to 0 in the usual way, giving us our count of 1001. Note that in this instance, the least significant digit is shown on the left to conform with a certain diagram here. Then the next input clock pulse comes along, and this will give us our count of 1001, since A will be switched. Our next input clock pulse will cause A to reset back to 0. This will do nothing to B and C, since they will be inhibited by D being on. However, a clock pulse will be generated into the D line, into the C line of flip-flop D, causing it to reset to zero. So it will prematurely reset to all zeros after the count of 9. Because the counter has got 10 discrete states, it's capable of representing one decimal decade. The unused state analysis here is important. When the circuit is initially switched on, it could assume one of the illegal or unused states, that is to say, from binary 10, binary for decimal 10 through 15. And with some counters, it's possible to have a lockup situation occurring, where, for example, if you initially switched on and it was represented as 11 in a counter, it might go to 13, 14, then back to 11, 13, 14, and so on, and sequence round in an illegal sequence. That's not true of this particular counter, as we can see, but we must consider the unused state analysis. If initially we are switched to 1010, which is binary 10 and illegal, application of a clock pulse will put us over to 1011, another illegal state, but application of the next clock pulse will switch us from 1011 to a legal combination 0100, binary 4. Likewise for other illegal states. If we examine the output waveforms of this counter, we'll see that for a given input frequency, the output of A will be half the input frequency, which is as we would expect, this complements for every clock pulse coming in. B gives an output of 4 outputs for every, that's right, 4 outputs for every 10 inputs, so one could consider it dividing by 2.5, I suppose. C output divides by 5, and D output divides by 10. Thus, you can divide by other than parts of 2 with special counters. But as I mentioned previously, you can divide by any integer that you should wish to. Well, you remember that our sole reason for considering BCD was because very often you want some kind of human interface to a machine, and you need to have a decimal readout of a particular binary combination within a register. For this purpose, you need some kind of a decoder. What's shown here is a BCD to decimal decoder. Which consists of 10 AND gates. In actual practice, these would be combinations of NANDs and NORs, but for the purposes of this, I just show simply the AND gates. And the function of the decoder is to take to sense a particular combination of ones and zeros in a 4-bit register, and appropriately set any one, but only one, of these output lines to high. In the event, for example, that we have A at 1 and D at 1 and the others at 0, this is 1001, and equivalent to decimal 9, and this should cause the output of 9, and only the output of 9, to go high. Thus, our register input is from the left here, and our output at the top will go to some display device, which we should talk about in a second too. There are actually 8 inputs shown here from the register. This is solely because we make use of the fact that most flip-flops have both a 1 and a 0 output, so we have inputs for A and not A here. Let's see how well or how this decoder works. The state of 0, is when we have not A, and not B, and not C, and not D. That's the only possible, only situation when that occurs, when we have 0. And if you examine the logic diagram, you'll see that it's a 4 input AND gate that drives the 0 line, and it is connected to not A, not B, not C, and not D. Thus, when that particular combination of zeros occurs, the zero output will be set to logical 1. 1 will be logical 1 when we have A and not B and not C and not D. 2 now will be logical 1 when we have B and not A and not C. In other words, 0, 1, 0. Now, we don't need to consider the D bit in this situation. We're making use of the fact that there are a whole string of illegal combinations of ones and zeros. These are the binary equivalents for decimal 10 through 15. And if we can make use of that fact, we can see that binary 2 occurs when we have 0, 1, 0 here in these particular columns in the sequence. And nowhere else does that particular sequence of bits occur. It would occur if we were going to be counting in binary through these illegal combinations, 10 through 15. Since it doesn't, we can get by only considering 3 bits. Likewise, for 3, we only consider A, B, and C bits. With A and B both set, and C reset, 3 line will be unjumped. You can check this by looking at the diagram here. Likewise, for 4, 5, 6, and 7, 8, we can decode 8 by merely considering 2 inputs. When we have A as 0, not A, that is, we have not A and D, 8 is true. And we can see that when we have not A and D, that's 1 and 0 in the extreme right and left hand column respectively. The only situation when that occurs is when we do in fact have 8. Likewise, 9 is A and D. Only when we have both A and D true simultaneously is the situation 9 true in the counter. So 9 is a 2 input AND gate from the A and D lines. That then is a decoder, but what does it drive? Well, it will drive a display device, something like a XY work table or digital voltmeter frequency counter, something like this. And display devices, there are 3 major ones at this point in time, possibly 4. Historically, the main type of cold cathode, the main type of indicator has been the cold cathode numerical indicator, otherwise called a Nixon tube, trademark of Burris Corporation. And this consists of a glass envelope filled with some inert gas. And within the envelope is a single plate or anode, which is connected to a relatively high B plus supply, around 200 volts or so. And then a series of 10 cathodes, appropriately shaped 0 through 9. And by applying sufficient polarity between any one cathode and the plate, we can get ionization of the gas in a particular character shape around that particular cathode, and thus illuminate the particular decimal digit in this particular context. Although, of course, you can display any particular character you choose. There's two particular problems with this kind of device. One is that you need a fairly high voltage for the B plus line. If we're talking about integrated circuits, the kind of power supply voltage we're talking of is probably in the region of 4 or 5 volts. In any event, not more than about 15. And it becomes that little bit more expensive to provide an extra power supply just to drive the cold cathode numerical indicator tubes. Secondly, in order to switch on a particular cathode, we need a fairly substantial voltage swing on that cathode. And both that's not true at this particular point in time. Historically, it would be rather difficult to provide fairly high voltage swings from semiconductor devices. And a voltage swing, depending upon the tube, of course, is in the region of 30, 40 volts. The third point is that these tubes are fairly expensive. In the region, I suppose one could get down to around $3, $3.50, depending upon the characteristics of the tube. Maybe you can get them cheaper if you know a particular source. But there is another type, and this is, in fact, a type that was used in the kit that goes along with the seminar. And this is the incandescent 7-segment display device. And this uses incandescent wires to illuminate a particular numeral. Imagine then these 7 segments, 7 separate filaments, trade labeled A through G here. And these are within some glass envelope. And there will be a common point which is connected to one end of each of these segments. And by passing current through one or more of them, the segment will be illuminated, and we can display the character 2, for example, 2 consisting of illumination of segments A, B, G, E, and D. 9, likewise. It's not perhaps such a pleasing type of display as a cold cathode device. However, it's fairly inexpensive. These devices can also be driven directly from solid-state devices, as indeed can these. And we have in a single integrated circuit package, things like the SN7447, which is a decoder and a driver for this particular display, and indicates, I think that's one of the integrated circuits, all in a single package, a fairly low price too. Another type of display which is becoming more popular is the LED display, a light emitting diode. And this is where you have a similar type of 7-segment display like this, but rather than have the display built up from lines, it'll be a row of light emitting diodes arranged in a particular configuration. Hewlett Packard right now have got a LED type display on a single IC chip, which consists of the decoder, the driver, and the display all on a single package, which is just a little bit bigger than the thumbnail, which is quite a fantastic degree of complexity. Well, we talked about serial counters, but what about the other kind, the synchronous counter or the clocked variety? So the problem of the serial one was one of propagation delay, and also this problem of switching from one state to the other, where you had more than one flip-flop changing, you had some uncertainty associated with what the counter was doing in the transition period because of the ripple through. Now, in the synchronous type of counter, the clock pulse, you'll notice, is applied to each and every flip-flop in parallel, as it were, so that if any changes are going to take place, they are going to take place simultaneously. All flip-flops change state at the same time if there's going to be a change. And whether or not there's going to be a change will depend upon the state of the change taillines, of course. Now, the particular counter here is a 4-bit synchronous binary counter. And you see it's a little bit more complex than the first serial binary counter. That's the addition of two gates here. In order to explain just how this works, let's just quickly dodge back and have a look at this slide, which shows the decimal and binary equivalents for the numbers 0 through 15. And let's examine and see under what situation we want a change of A, B, C, and D as we are counting up from 0 to 15. A must change with every clock pulse applied. That's no problem. But B will only change when A is a 1. You'll notice that initially B is 0, 0 again. Now this time A is a 1, and a change will occur in B. It will switch to the 1 state. Here again, only when A is a 1 does B switch. You don't know which way it switches. All I'm saying is that it will complement whenever A is a 1. Now C will change only when both A and B are 1. Thus initially C is all zeros, then we come to this state here, count number 3, when A and B are both 1, and then the next clock pulse should cause state change in C. Likewise, when we get down to the count of 7, we'll only get a change when A and B are 1, so the next one will cause C to come to the back to 0. If we look at D, we will see that D does not change unless we have A and B and C all 0 simultaneously. And that occurs at a count of 7 to 8 and a count of 15 to 0. Well, now let's have a look at the counter and see how in fact that is performed. Well, you see that B, J and K inputs are connected to A1 output. Consequently, B will only complement when A1 output is high, that is to say, A is set to 1.
Excuse me, sir. Move the thing a little bit.
I'm sorry.
Get it all in.
Thank you. A will complement every time. B will only complement or switch when A is set to 1, so this conforms to our first rule. So to look at C, well, C, J, and K inputs are connected to the output of a 2-input AND gate, and the 2 inputs are for A and B. Incidentally, I should just remind you that in your notes, you may find that this line is in fact omitted. So if you want to know your notes spot on, just connect A1 output to the first 2-input AND gate. That's this line here. I'll put an arrow. Try to line was missing in the transcription. Thus, CJ and K will be true only when we have A and B set to 1, and D, J and K inputs will be true when A and B and C are all worked simultaneously. So we would expect this to count in the normal manner, and indeed will count synchronously. Every state change will occur at exactly the same time. The next slide is a little bit, it's quite an interesting simple counter. It's a bidirectional counter. Not only will it count up, but it will also count down, depending upon the state of a mode line. When this is in the 1 logical condition, the counter will count up. When it's in the logical 0 condition, the counter will count down. So that as we're counting up, you're 0, 1, 2, 3, up to 15, recycle that to 0. When we're counting down, it'll be 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, back to 0. For the next clock pulse, we'll go to all bombs of 15. In order to explain how this works, let us again look back at our previous sequence and let us examine conditions under which we should have a change in state for the A, B, C, and D flip-flops when counting down. Well, we can see again that A should complement every time. As we go from 15 down, it goes 1, 0, 1, 0, and so on. So that's just exactly as it was before. Under what conditions will B change? Well, it's initially 1. It needs to change when A is a 0 this time. So whenever A is a 0, we'll find the next clock pulse will cause B to change. That occurs then at that transition from 14 to 13. And it occurs from 12 to 11 and 10 to 9. The conditions for C changing are when both A and B are 0. So that occurs at this point on a count of 12. When both A and B are 0, we'll get the transition of the C flip-flop to the 0 state. And as you can imagine, we'll get a change on D line when A, B, C are all 0. And this is for when we're counting down. So it must have a circuit which must recognize, first of all, when it's counting up, must recognize ones in A, B, C, D, and so on. When it's counting down, it must recognize zeros in A, B, C, D. This is the circuit. It's actually just shown as 3 bits simplify it. We could extend it to 4, 5, 6 bits. We just need more inputs on these NAND gates here. The J and K lines, let's have a look at the J and K line of C flip-flop. The J and K line must be either true, let's say it must be either A and B for when it's counting up, or not A and not B for when it's counting down. And when we're counting up, the mode line, or M, is set to 1. So we can say that our J and K inputs here must be either M, that's counting up, and A and B. Under those conditions, if we're counting up and A and B are both 1, the J and K lines must be high and the complement must occur of C. Or, if we're counting down, that is to say, not M is true, and we have a 0 in A and a 0 in B, a complement must occur. So providing the J and K inputs to C satisfy this logical equation, then it will in fact count up and count down. You can see this is in fact the case. This 3 input NAND gate here has an output of NOT, MODE, and A and B. This 3 input NAND gate has an output of NOT, the NOT MODE, because the MODE is inverted here, NOT A from the first flip-flop, and NOT B from the next flip-flop. The outputs of these are then NANDed through this 2 input NAND gate, giving us an output of NOT, not M, and not A and not B, and not M, A, and B, which by De Morgan results to this. That's really the whole story, I think. It's a 3-bit synchronous binary up-down counter. And the particular count sequence is shown here, and it's exactly the same as our previous binary counters, so that we have 2 count sequences, one for up, 21 for now. Well, so far we've discussed synchronous binary counters. Now let's have a look at a synchronous BCD counter, one which must count in BCD. That is to say, it must prematurely reset, as it were, when it reaches the count of 9. This counts in much the same way as our previous binary counters. The input to flip-flop B, the J line, will be high when we have A high, and the other input to the AND gate is true, that is to say, not D is true. So initially then, we have a counter 0000 in the register, not D is true, so this AND gate is enabled, and normal binary counting will occur between A and B. That is to say, when A is 1, we will get a transition on B. We'll always get transitions on A because J and K both make it in high for A. Flip-flop C, its input comes from B and from A, thus it's quite normal, just like the previous counter, which will change then when we have an A and a B both set to 1. And D, J input, has a 3 input AND gate feeding it, thus this is when A and B and C are all set to 1. However, notice that as soon as D sets, its 0 output will fall, disabling the 2 input AND gate feeding B. What happens then? It counts in normal sequence up to a count of 1, 1, 1 for A, B, and C. Application of the next clock pulse will cause A to complement. B will also complement because its J input is I, and likewise its K. C will also complement to 0, and D will set to 1. We're now at a count of 8. 0 output will have fallen, disabling B, J input. The next input pulse causes A to set to 1, which is now the 9 condition. And with A set to 1, then the 1 output will be high, and the 1 output, you'll notice, is connected round to the K input of D. So now we're in this situation, D is 1, B and C both 0, and A is 1, and the K input is high. Now with K input high, this means to say that D will reset to 0 for the next clock pulse. Thus the next clock pulse, A will toggle or complement back to 0, and D will reset to 0, and we'll be back at square 1. Nothing will happen to B and C since this 2 input AND gate here is disabled. This has the advantage then of the previous serial BCD counter that all state changes occur simultaneously. In the notes you'll find further examples of synchronous BCD counters at this particular moment. I don't plan to go into them in detail. Remember that the third type of counter or register is the shift type. Here is a very simple shift register, which is composed of 4 JK flip-flops, with the output of each one, the 1 and 0 outputs being connected to the J and K inputs for consecutive flip-flops. A shift register is where we have a number such as, let's suppose we have a number 1100 in this counter. If we apply a shift pulses code to this, the numbers, the bits, will be shifted towards the right. Now if we enter in zeros from this end, 1100 will be shifted to become 0110. You can imagine zeros floating out the end, dropping off, and zeros floating in this end. This process effectively divides a number by powers of 2. Thus, if you started off with 1100, this would shift to 110. That is to say, 12 would become 6, and further shift would end up with two ones in the rightmost stages, which would be three. You carry the process on, you want to give you one and a half, or three, we'll shift over to one. If you shift towards the left, this is effectively multiplying a number by two. Let's see how it works. Suppose that the leftmost register here is in the one state. This means to say that the one output would be high. So with the one output high and the zero output low, and this is in the one state, then the conditions are such as to set a one into the next flip-flop to the right. Since J is high and K is low, this means we'll set a 1. We can say then that the 1 which was present in this flip-flop has been propagated over. Now, what will go into this particular flip-flop, the one on the left, is dependent upon what the state of the J and K lines are initially. And we could either tie them to ground, in which case, if we tie them to ground, there will be no action, or we could set K high and J low, in which case we would insert zeros, or we could insert 1s. In the event that there is already a zero in this flip-flop, this means to say that the one output will be low, the zero output will be high, and this is conducive to setting a zero into the next flip-flop. In other words, we could say a zero is being propagated over. Now, the shift register is, as you can see, very simple. It's very inexpensive, very few gates, in this case no gates in between each stage. We're going to get rather interesting properties when we start looping the output back into the input. And this is done in the switch tail encounter, which is shown here. Now in the switch tail encounter, the one output of D is switched over and connecting back to the K input of A. We could have connected the one output straight back to the J input of A, in which case we would have ended up with some form of ring counter. But by switching the outputs like this, it means to say that if a zero is propagated out of D, it isn't lost anymore. It's reinserted at the left-hand side as a 1. So zeros floating out become 1s this end. And likewise, if 1s float out of D, they are reinserted as 0 at A. If the counter is initially reset to all zeros, as shown here, the application of the first shift pulse, a pulse applied to all clock inputs in parallel, will cause the zero of D to be shifted out and looped back into A, as it were, and we'll end up with 0001. Application of a further clock pulse will shift another 1 into A, and another 1 will get into further 1, and the fourth clock pulse will cause all bits to be set, and the next clock pulse will shift a 1 out of D, which will be reinserted as 0, giving us 0, 1, 1, 1. Application of the next clock pulse again, and 1 is shifted out, reinserted as a 0, giving us 2 zeros and 2 ones. The 7th will give us 3 zeros and a 1. And finally, on the 8th clock pulse, we'll be back at square 1, our starting point. Shift registers like this are rather useful in sequencing operations for timing, signals generating, synchronizing. One can decode the state of simple ring counters very effectively. There's further information given in the notes. And I'd just like to conclude with one rather interesting fact about the switch tail ring counter, and that is that if you switch it on initially, it assumes one of the states is not set here. There are 8 different states. If it assumes a state other than this, it will count through another complete cycle, but it will never get back into this. In other words, you have 2, shall we say, independent cycles that the register can go through, and depending on how it's initially set up and it's initially switched on, will depend upon what particular sequence it will operate through. So, in a particular application, you would want to initially, say, reset all counters to 0, or registers to 0, or preset to some initial known count. And if you would like to work, I'm not quite sure whether it's in the notes, but if you like to work it out sometime, start off with a 1010 and work through that. So you'll find out that you go through a completely different count sequence. Gentlemen, that concludes my presentation. I think my colleague, Dr. Little, is going to talk about the realization of mini computers and control logic.
Thank you.